Okay. So we actually got that far, huh? It's permanent duration. It's universal scope. Yeah, we did look at these. It's height and strength. We did look at that too. So then we got the special functions of the law for the Christian. Right. And this is where we... Okay. Very good. Thank you very much. My assistant was just confirming for me that's exactly where we were. This is chapter 19. All right. And here's what we've done. We're looking at paragraph 6 and 7. I'll just give you at least the first two because they're on this slide. And here's what we're looking at. The special functions of the law of God for Christians, and we'll read paragraph 6 again because it is important, and that's why I wanted to just finish up today, because this is specifically talking about the law of God and its role for Christians. I mean, we've talked about the role of the law, that it's a universal scope. Everybody's under the obligation to keep the law. There's nobody who's excluded. It's not just for religious people. It's not just for Christians. But now we're looking at the specific function of the law of God for Christians. So let's look at paragraph 6 again, and we'll read through it carefully again and pick up where we left off. Although true believers be not under the law as a covenant of works, to be thereby justified or condemned, let's just stop there, because I think that's important. Notice very clearly, we are no longer judged by the law. We are no longer required to keep the law for our justification, and our breaking of the law will not in fact condemn us. All right? Now we have to be careful, because that sounds almost antinomian, but it's not. The reason that first sentence is there is so that we understand that if we are those who have been saved by Jesus Christ, His atonement has already covered our sin, and that is why we are no longer bound by the obligation for justification. Notice the words carefully. That does not mean that we are still not obligated to keep the law for other reasons, because we are. All right? What would be some of the other reasons that we're obligated to keep the law? In fact, there's one overriding, reason. Not for our justification, because our justification is a done deal if you're the one who has been saved. So why else? Why are we supposed to keep the law of God and actually bound to keep the law? Go ahead. Because He wrote it, that's one reason. It glorifies Him, certainly. Yep. It's practical. Yep. That's always a good reason. It's very practical for us. For sanctification. We're commanded to be sanctified. How do you know what is required of your sanctification? It's the law of God which tells us what we must do to become like Christ. I mean, it'd be one thing... we're told to be conformed to the image of Jesus Christ. What is the image of Jesus Christ? Who has seen Jesus Christ today? Anybody who raises their hand, please see me afterwards. We've got a long talk that we have to have. Okay? None of us have seen Christ. None of us have walked with Christ. We haven't lived with Christ for 3.5 years when He was on earth so that we can emulate the things that we saw. Okay, so how do we know what Christ did? Because certainly there's things that Christ did in the Gospels that we're not supposed to do. I'm not going to go to Lake Ronkonkoma this afternoon and try to walk to the other side. Well, Christ did that, but I don't think I'm going to try that. Okay, so what is it? Everything that Christ did is not ours to emulate. So what is? It's the law. Remember, because the law of God is what describes the holy character of God. And that's what we are to become. Just as Peter says, just as it is written, be ye holy, for I am holy. What is holiness? The law of God defines holiness. Okay? Do you see the difference? Do you see why we have such a problem with those who are truly antinomian? when they say, no, the law is not for us today, we're no longer under the law, that's it. It's over, done with. Don't even mention the law. Don't hang the Ten Commandments up. And you realize that the church not too far from here, down in Blue Point, would never have those two tablets that we do have hanging up on their wall. They think that's a terrible thing. But no, that's the character of God. And that's why that's one reason we have them hanging up there, because we want people to be constantly reminded the Ten Commandments, the law of God, is applicable for us today. All right. So that's, and that's what we see. And yet it is of grace use to them as well as to others, in that as a rule of life, informing them of the will of God and their duty, it directs and binds them to walk accordingly, discovering also the sinful pollutions of their natures, hearts, and lives, so as examining themselves thereby they may come to further conviction of, humiliation for, and hatred against sin. This is describing your sanctification. It's exactly what it's doing. Together with a clearer sight of the need they have of Christ and the perfection of His obedience. Notice, one of the continued functions of the law is that we don't get cocky, that we don't become arrogant. And just because, remember, one of the things that the Arminian accuses us of, is that if you hold to the perseverance of the saints, you're going to become arrogant. That's an arrogant position, and it will certainly lead to people willfully sinning. Because if you're saved, and you know you're saved to the very end, then what's the motivation, you know, not to sin? Whereas the Arminian says, no, my motivation not to sin is I'm afraid I'm going to lose my salvation. Well, according to the chapter here in the confession, what it's basically saying is not that, firstly, that would never be a good motivation for you not to sin, because no matter how hard you try, you're never going to keep the law perfectly. So if anything, the motivation to keep the law from losing your salvation would be just as horrendous as trying to keep the law to earn your salvation. There would be nothing more frustrating. You know? If you tell me, if you give me a precious gift, and then you say, now in order to keep this precious gift, you can never sin again. You know what I do? I give it back to you right now. Because I know I'm going to sin again. In fact, when you told me that, I probably had some sinful thoughts about you right at that moment. You know, how dare you? Set me up for failure. So I probably have to confess right then and there. So I've already blown, so I'm going to give it right back to you. Okay. And it would be the same thing. I mean, it would be almost a dirty trick for God to grant us this precious gift and say, okay, now to keep this, you can never sin again. No. That's certainly no motivation. That would lead to utter despair. And which is why I believe that most Arminians don't believe what they say they believe. I don't believe they believe what they say they believe. Because if they did, they would be living defeated lives. And not all of them do. I think some of them do. I think some of them really struggle with these things. But I think some of them really understand the grace of God more than what their theology says. And so they got some wires crossed, you know, upstairs. But then we all have some wires crossed, right? Yeah, it'd be a good thing you're shaking your head. All I got to do is look outside and see how crossed your wires are. I'm only teasing. It's really a nice car. All right. Later. Okay. It is likewise of use. Let me get it right here. It is likewise of use to the regenerate to restrain their corruptions, in that it forbids sin, and the threatenings of it serve to show what even their sins deserve and what afflictions in this life they may expect from them, although freed from the curse and unallayed rigor thereof. In other words, what that's saying is, even though it's not a matter of salvation, it's not a matter of justification, what the law of God basically says is that when you commit certain violations, you can expect certain consequences. Not salvific consequences, but certainly consequences in this life. For example, very clearly, if you're a Christian and you steal, okay, you're not going to lose your salvation, but you may lose your freedom. You may go to jail, and rightly so. And you may have restitution. And if we were to follow the biblical model, it would not only pay back what you stole, but twice more. Okay, so that's what the law of God does too. It says, you know what, it helps keep you on what they call the straight and narrow, because there are temporal consequences, you know, for the things. Because the law of God is pervasive. It's not strictly pertaining to spiritual matters. And this is, again, is something that we have to really keep in mind. You can't make a clear-cut dichotomy between the physical world and the spiritual. That's a grave error. That's Gnosticism to do that. What we're saying is, certainly the spiritual realm is of primary importance. But everything that happens in the physical realm will manifest itself, in the spiritual realm, will manifest itself in the physical realm, one way or another. Get right back to the two great commandments, which is what we've been, you know, focusing in our study in Romans. One of the things that we've seen is our love for God must be manifested in our love for one another. If it's not, then you don't really love God. You see, and that's what I'm talking about, the connection between the physical realm and the spiritual realm. And people try to make such a distinction between that. And quite frankly, and I don't want to get into the eschatological discussion, but quite frankly, this is my biggest problem with amillennialism. Amillennialism tries to really make a distinction between, oh no, Christ will be victorious in the spiritual realm, and his kingdom will continue to grow, but it's just not going to have much of an impact in the physical realm. I'm sorry, I have a problem with that. If Christ's kingdom is growing in the spiritual realm, of necessity it's going to have an impact in the physical realm. I'm not saying that you have to become a postmillennialist. Yeah, maybe I am. No, I'm teasing. But you got to at least see the relationship of the two kingdoms. Okay? Christ made it clear that his kingdom was not of this realm. In other words, it was not of this world. But his kingdom transcends this world and supersedes and has impact. When a realm in this world becomes ungodly, God punishes that realm. Clearly, that's what happens. Why do we have so many cultures that seem to be advancing in science and in mathematics, and all of a sudden, and you know, we didn't even know about these cultures in Western civilization, and then all of a sudden we discover like the Mayans. Why are they gone? If they were so smart. Well, clearly, now that we know more about them. And I didn't see the movie, but I understand Mel Gibson made a movie about the Mayan culture, didn't he? Was it just recently? Yeah. I mean, I didn't go see it because it was incredibly graphic and gory. And, I mean, if you found out what they actually believed, what they did to their enemies when they conquered them, and, I mean, gross. You know, human relations violations, or human rights violations, if you might say. Even to use that word is almost ludicrous. But when a culture becomes that ungodly, God says, God will only let a culture reach a certain spot. He did it with the whole world. The whole world was getting so ungodly, he had the flood and wiped out everybody except those whom he chose. You know, to carry on with the promise, okay? And actually, I mean, he could have wiped out the whole human race if he wanted. Why did he choose Moses? Noah. Why did he choose Moses? Why did he choose Noah and his sons? Because they were so godly? No, because he had chosen them. Because, I mean, Follow the life of Moses. Why do I keep going to Moses? Follow the life of Noah and his sons after they came out of the ark. You know, I'm not so sure I want them for my next door neighbor. Okay. No, what made the difference? Because God was going to preserve his seed. He chose Noah, and he set his affection upon Noah, and that's why Noah was blameless and upright. Not because he was so much better in character than everybody else. I mean, we see his foibles as well. All right? And the overriding reason? Because God is not a liar. He said he was going to redeem mankind, and he did. And so, and he made the way. And he chose Noah and his sons and daughters-in-law to accomplish that very thing. Okay? So afflictions for life, although freed from the curse and light rigor. The promises of it likewise show them God's approbation of obedience and what blessings they may expect upon the performance thereof, though not as due them by the law as a covenant of works. Okay, here's what the confession is saying now, is even though you can expect, and if you will, and I'll take you back to Deuteronomy 28, blessings and cursings in one sense, not in exactly the same sense as when God gave the law to the Israelites, because technically a Christian can never be cursed, okay? But the principle of blessings and cursings, or blessings and consequences might be a better way of saying it. That's what you can expect, and that's what the confession says. As you obey God's law, you can expect the hand of God's blessing to come upon you. As you disobey, you can expect consequences from it. So, again, not for salvation. Salvation's over. It's done. If you're one of his, you've been set aside, you've been marked out, nothing can change that. But as you live your life, if you follow God's law, expect blessing. If you don't follow God's law, you can expect consequences. You can expect problems, and they will come. But the difference is, if you're a Christian, those consequences you can look upon as being disciplined from God to bring you back and to restore you. And see, and that's another purpose of the law. All right. And again, I think the confession, you know, just says it, you know, so well. All right. Then, so as man's doing good and refraining from evil, because the law encourages to the one and deters from the other, is no evidence of his being under law and not under grace. Okay, here's where we come down and let's look at the harmonious operation of these functions. Okay, this is the end of paragraph 6 and moving into paragraph 7 of the confession. Spurgeon was once asked, how do you reconcile law and grace? Because obviously Spurgeon preached the doctrines of grace rigorously, okay? And so he was asked a question, you know, Dr. Spurgeon, how do you reconcile law and grace? And his answer, I think, was just so profound. He said, you don't have to reconcile friends. Okay. In other words, that would be like me, if we have two friends and they're sitting here and they're laughing and having a good time together, and somebody comes up and says, how do you reconcile these two? Reconcile what? There's no argument. You know, there's no problem going on here. What's to be reconciled? And that's what Spurgeon had in mind. There's no problem between law and grace. They're not in contradiction. And so all those people who try to set the law of God aside, say, no, we're not under law, we're under grace, are misquoting what we've seen in Romans. And I'm not going to go through that whole thing because we did a big exposition of that in the morning service. And that's what the confession is doing here as well, saying, yes, you were absolutely right. We're not under law for our salvation. We're under grace for our salvation. And praise be to God. I mean, we don't try to negate any of those principles. But just as Christ said, that doesn't mean that the law does not have a function for you. And so that's where the tension comes in. And even for us, being those who hold to the law of God, that we have to make sure that we use the law properly. In fact, the scripture says that the law is good and holy and just if it's used lawfully, if it's used properly. And that's what we have to make sure, is that we're using the law properly and not using it improperly. We don't use the law as a club, you know, and to swing and beat people with. The law is that which is to encourage. It's to bring us to grace. The unsaved person, it brings to grace, showing them their utter destitution of ever being able to keep this law. And then, so what's the, you know, what's my remedy? How am I saved if I can never keep this law? I know I can't keep this law. Here's the answer. The answer is grace of God. Now, which is one of the reasons why I like, you know, the series that we're doing in the afternoon Bible study, The Way of the Master. Both, you know, Kirk Cameron and Ray Comfort. I've known about Ray Comfort for, wow, it's got to be over 20 years. And he did a message entitled The Ten Canons of God's Law, which I think is absolutely excellent. It's still a very relevant message for today. And the idea is that it is the law that brings you to salvation, to show the need of your salvation. It's only the grace of God that can do it. And he gives a great illustration, and maybe you've never heard it, but I'm going to give it to you. He likens it to riding on a plane. And he says, and somebody coming to you while you're sitting on the plane and says, and gives you a parachute. And they say, here, take the parachute. And he says, well, what do I need the parachute for? Well, you know, it's going to be good for you. You know, it's going to make your plane ride more comfortable. You're going to have this safety feeling about you, you know, it's just going to make your plane ride that much better. Okay? And after, so the guy puts the parachute on. And after a while, he sees people laughing at him. What's he wearing the parachute for? And doesn't the guy know that you can't jump out of a 747 anyway? You know? And, you know, all these kinds of things. And, you know, say, you're just snickering. And then he finds out, one, it's not making him more comfortable. It's bulky. Sitting on the back, he can't stretch out, even if he lays down. And then he's getting hot, he's starting to sweat. So what does he do? Takes the parachute off. All right? That's a little bit different than if you go to somebody and tell them, put this parachute on. Well, why? Well, because I happen to know that was a problem with the engines, and in about 10 minutes, they're all going to stop. And we're going to have about 5 minutes, you know, to bail out of this plane. Think he's going to put the parachute on? Sure. That's the analogy he used. Of course, it's not a perfect analogy, but I think it's somewhat relevant. People are giving people the gospel, telling them you need to come to Christ because it's going to make everything better for you. You're going to be healthy, wealthy, and wise. And, you know, you're one of God's children. And anything that you want, you know, the world is your oyster. And all you got to do is pluck and ask God. And if you have enough faith, you're going to get everything that you ever, anything your heart, little heart desires, you're going to be able to get. Okay? As opposed to somebody coming saying, guess what? Here's the law of God. You know what? And if you violated even one of these, and as Kirk Cameron says, it was difficult to go to his mother and telling her she's a lying thief. Okay? you're a lying, murderous, adulterous thief, okay, who is a blasphemer, okay, and a covetous person. And if you're guilty of even one of those, you're bound for hell. Now, there's a remedy for that. Here's your parachute. Okay. One is going to bring true conviction of sin. I mean, granted, I mean, we know that there are people that even when you explain that to them, say, no. But that's not the point. The point is you have to give them the truth. And it's only the law that is going to show them the truth. Does that make sense to everybody? You see the different use. And again, any analogy is, you know, can only be used so far, and it's certainly flawed, you know, if you take it beyond that. But I think that's a good one. So the fact of the harmonious operation and the explanation of this, let's just read the last paragraph. Neither are the aforementioned uses of the law contrary to the grace of the gospel, but do sweetly comply with it, the Spirit of Christ subduing and enabling the will of man to do that freely and cheerfully which the will of God revealed in the law requires to be done. Now, there's the last key, and on this we'll close in just a couple of minutes. And this is what I was saying, you know, even after you explain it, you offer the person the parachute, some people are going to say no. And what's the difference? The confession still in harmony with everything it's taught us before. It's only those who've been enlightened. It's only the grace of God in the heart that's going to allow the person even to see their sinfulness. Apart from that, the person will say, no, I'm okay. And again, you know, I'll refer you to the Way of the Master series, okay, where what we find is people say, you know, how do you see yourself before God? You know, well, I'm okay. I'm doing fine. You're going to go to heaven? Oh, sure. Why? Well, I've done more good than bad. You know, I'm not such a bad person. God's a forgiving God. I don't believe that God's going to condemn me to hell. I mean, you know, look at all the good things I do. I'm a loving father. I haven't cheated on my wife. You know what I mean? I give my boss an honest day's work. And guess what? There are people like that out there, right? We have neighbors, family, friends who are really lovable people. But guess what? It's not what they do with us. What do they do with God? They've still sinned against God, and unless they recognize that they're sinners against Him, then all the good works and all the niceties that they do here are all for naught. And that's why God has to be the one to open the eyes of the heart. And if He doesn't open the eyes of the heart, they're always going to remain in their own deception. Okay, any final thoughts? Because we're just about at the end. We've finished the chapter on law. And notice again how these things all work together. There's a definite order that they put the confession in, and notice how it keeps building upon one another. All right, Jerry, would you close us in prayer?